it had the buying power of 30 of the dollars we have today. Put simply, a dollar went a long way in 1900. Saving up $1,000 back then was enough for a down payment on a nice house, a piece of land, or something significant. $1,000 in 1900 had the value of over $30,000 today. However, if your ancestor stuck that hefty $1,000 savings in an envelope marked for you to open today, it would barely cover 1 month of rent at a down-market apartment complex. The value of government money doesn't look good over time. Hard work and savings erode through periodic devaluations. There were key moments in the 20th century when dollar wealth sustained a serious blow. Holding gold during those periods meant preserving the purchasing power of wealth through those devaluations. While the value of a dollar today is worth far less than that same dollar in 1900, the exact opposite is true for gold. If your ancestor swapped the $1,000 of hard-earned savings for gold and put that in an envelope, you'd have 48 ounces worth of gold worth more than $80,000 today. That means gold not only preserved wealth and purchasing power over the same period, it appreciated. As we'll discuss in the following chapters, this century might be different. The threat of radical devaluation today is higher than ever. In the 20th century, the U.S. won world wars. At one point, it controlled roughly 60% of the official world gold supply. It patrolled the air, land, and seas of the planet. Meanwhile, it ran what felt like serious budget shortfalls at the time. Even after losing two-thirds of its national gold reserve under the Bretton Woods Agreement, it still held supremacy through the end of the century. The strength to overcome these circumstances came from the U.S. economic engine. In the wake of each debt increase, it generated higher GDP and, in turn, higher tax revenue. That engine shows signs of failure today. It takes increasingly large sums of debt to keep the economy afloat. Servicing that debt requires more debt. Years ago, a small government deficit gave the economy a big boost. Today, giant deficits barely move the needle. As this power fades, debts mount up. Like a junkie, the government needs greater and greater piles of debt just to maintain its position. That's unsustainable. Gold is the ultimate protection for what now looks inevitable. In the following pages, I'll show you how the price of one gold ounce cost 500% more than it did on January 1st, 2000. That compares to a share of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway stock, which grew only 398%. Or the S&P 500 index, which rose only 93% over the same period. People say gold is boring, useless, without income, and even a barbarous relic of a bygone era. In the coming years, it might be your only chance to preserve the wealth that represents your life's work. Part 2. Why now? Introduction. It's time to be realistic. After looking to the past, we're certain about two things. First, gold is money. Over long periods of time, it preserved, protected, and often grew wealth like no other asset. It's liquid, meaning someone will buy it, even in the depths of depression. Gold doesn't depend on another party for its worth. Bonds depend on a borrower to pay interest. Stocks depend on companies to generate profits. Apartments depend on tenants to pay rent. Gold depends on nothing. That makes it unique among all other assets. In the years to come, that feature will prove to have inestimable value. The second thing that's clear after looking to the past is governments have a bad habit of destroying the value of their money over time. Simply put, politicians can't resist spending tomorrow's savings today. The temptation is too great. This has nothing to do with politics. Over long periods of time, right, left, or center is irrelevant. Modern media drums up a circus to keep you distracted from seeing the main issue. Once you see the inevitable path ahead for modern money, you may lose interest in politics permanently. Periods of fiscal restraint occasionally pop up. They usually follow economic turmoil or popular revolt. The public tends to watch over politicians more in the wake of a crisis. As time passes, memories fade. Slowly, governments always revert to their profligate ways. Over thousands of years, it's the same story. Just a little more borrowing seems reasonable. At times, it's the compassionate thing to do. Politicians whip up emotional stories to justify overspending. As we examine why now is the most critical time to shelter wealth from what's ahead, try to avoid falling prey to emotional distractions. If you can do that, you'll see the financial system is not what you think. The old days of running a small deficit to foster growth are over. The entire system is in trouble. In the end, it won't be a crash that wipes people out. It will be a financial reset. This means a swift conversion to a new money system. You won't get advance notice about a financial reset. The reset only works if it happens when few expect it. The topics we cover in the coming section will help you spot the clues. We'll expose the modern financial system for what it is, like a swindler running a scheme. The stakes are so big today, it takes enormous effort to maintain the facade. Forget about saving the structure beneath. Borrowing today merely pays interest on previous borrowing. There's no hope of fiscal solvency. Central bankers make television appearances like financial celebrities. Years ago, people barely knew they existed. As we get into the ugly truths about our financial system today, you'll need to let go of preconceived ideas. For instance, the U.S. is no longer a free market. We'll go over the evidence. You won't be able to take in the facts if you believe it's a free market simply because that's what you've been told. Preconceived ideas might get you into a lot of trouble in the years ahead. Your wealth is on the line. That means your future is on the line. Let's get into why now may be your last chance to protect hard-earned wealth from an inevitable reset of the current financial system. Chapter 10. The system as you know it is broken. On Monday morning, August 19th, 1991, every television set in the entire Soviet Union aired the same program. Changing the channel didn't help. A beautiful rendition of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake was a pleasant surprise, at first. The four-part ballet runs for about 3 hours. It ran over and over and over again for days. There are a few brief interruptions. An unfamiliar anchorman came on to give spotty updates on the state of things in Moscow. President Gorbachev was ill, allegedly. But all would be well. Enjoy the show. The average Soviet citizen had no idea what was going on in Moscow. They'd later call it the August coup. Over the prior weekend, coup leaders locked Gorbachev in his Crimean vacation home. The ballet kept everyone distracted while plotters put the plan in motion. In the end, it failed. However, 4 months later, the USSR also failed. The coup was a warning sign of major change ahead. Major changes always give advance notice. The problem is most people don't pay attention. They either don't want to or they can't. After change hits, they gripe and blame. Neither can restore the past. For the average Soviet, 1991 was a confusing time. Something was going on, but many people didn't know exactly what. The communist government controlled the media. That meant it controlled media messaging. Every government controls its domestic media. It realizes wisely that average people believe what they hear on television. They largely can't think for themselves. Hearing a message from a reporter with a credible appearance encourages trust. When it comes to spotting change on the horizon, a news anchor won't help. Worse, they'll tell you people talking about obvious change ahead are dangerous. The truth is, the only way to survive a big reset is to think for yourself. The clues appear in advance every time. The first step in this process is looking back at the past. While the methods change, the general flow of events does not. The next step is to take in the facts and tune out the media message. It's the commentary that gets people in trouble. It lulls them into complacency. They pass on the chance to act ahead of wealth-changing events. Some Soviets saw change coming. There were signs. There was also an alternative to waiting until it was too late. There was a robust underground economy in the Soviet Union. Premium goods and services lurked in the shadows. They changed hands in dollars. For those in the know, the dollar market offered some protection from wipeout. The people I've met who remember watching Swan Lake for days admit they didn't understand the warning signs. Meanwhile, those who did positioned for change. That change came when the Soviet system reset, creating a new class of wealth. Oligarchs emerged. Russia is a major economy today. Forget about its portrayal in the Western media for a moment. We're interested in how to spot warning signs ahead of big change. We'll leave the politics to everyone else. How the U.S. system used to work. We can't get into what's ahead for our wealth until we understand how the current system works. That is, how it used to work. Let's start with the basics. Most governments get their funding from taxing activity within its borders. In the U.S., taxes on imports, exports, business profits, and personal income make up most of its tax receipts. The economic activity happening within a country's borders is its gross domestic product, GDP. It's the total value of all goods and services produced in the country. On average, the U.S. collects 16 to 18% of GDP in total tax revenue. Regardless of what personal tax rates are, the government rarely collects more or less than 16 to 18% of total economic activity. GDP grew more than 90-fold between 1945 and 2020. Meanwhile, the percentage of GDP collected as taxes stayed about the same. Higher GDP means higher tax revenue. That's why governments want GDP to grow. As that pie grows, the government's slice gets bigger. In 2019, for instance, U.S. GDP was just under $21.5 trillion. The government collected $3.46 trillion in taxes that year. That's just over 16% of GDP. U.S. Treasury sells bonds to finance overspending. The U.S. spent $4.45 trillion in 2019. That's almost $1 trillion more than it received in tax revenue. It sells bonds to make up that $1 trillion shortfall. The U.S. Treasury sells bonds, bills, and notes with maturity dates as short as 4 weeks and as long as 30 years. When they come due, it sells more. The U.S. debt pile never shrinks. All of the debt sold by the U.S. Treasury carries the backing of the U.S. government, specifically the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. For more than a century, that's been a low-risk loan. As of mid-2020, that debt pile topped $25 trillion. It will grow much larger. It's never been cheaper for the country to build a mountain of debt. That's because interest on the debt is dirt cheap. The government pays less than 1% to borrow for as long as 10 years. It pays only 1.25% to borrow for 30 years. Where it once sold bonds, bills, and notes to the free market, its own central bank buys many of them today. That keeps a lid on borrowing costs. Imagine how many homes, cars, or businesses you could buy with a limitless supply of 1% credit. Take it one step further and imagine never having to repay the borrowed money. Each time a loan came due, you'd take another loan to pay it off. In this case, only a fool would sacrifice to pay off debt. Borrowing to fund an otherwise unaffordable lifestyle would be far easier. It's human nature. Naturally, if every loan gets cheaper and cheaper, there's no limit to how much you borrow. There's only one problem. If the interest rate charged on debt ever increased, it would mean instant wipeout. You'd have to make sure that rate did not rise. That's exactly what the U.S. does today. While it tripled the size of its debt pile, its interest expense barely budged. You'd expect its interest expense to also triple. That would be a normal consequence of any debt that tripled in size. But that's not what happened. The U.S. benefits today from the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. That means looking back 2,000 years, it's never been cheaper to go on a borrowing binge. Borrowing on this scale is not possible in a free market. In order to remain solvent, the U.S. has to suppress interest rates. No longer a free market. In Chapter 8, we discussed how fixing the price of oranges would punish premium orange growers while rewarding the worst growers. A free market produces the best oranges. The U.S. would never fix the price of oranges. When it comes to interest rates, it's a different story. Interest rates are the price of money. There's nothing free about how that market works in the U.S. The same goes for most of the developed world today. In a free market, buyers and sellers determine price. The way this would work in a free market for interest rates is higher rates would attract more buyers looking for a good return on their money. Lower rates would be less appealing. the free market would find middle ground. The problem is, if U.S. interest rates faced a free market, the country would be insolvent overnight. That can't happen. So the government does anything it has to do to keep interest rates as low as possible. In the past, other countries bought U.S. bonds receiving market interest rates for a safe investment. For instance, you'll hear people say, the Chinese own us, or we pay all that interest to China. In the 1980s, it was Japan, asserting that either will own us is way off base. Japan holds about 5% of the U.S. Treasury debt. It's the second largest holder. China is next with about 4%, according to data from Bloomberg in May of 2020. That means the second and third largest holders of U.S. Treasury debt don't even make up 10% of the total. Over the past 12 years, the U.S. central bank, the Federal Reserve, bought up the majority of the country's debt. The Fed started out as a small buyer of U.S. debt. Today, it's the majority holder. Soon it will be the entire market. That doesn't sound like a robust free market. If U.S. interest rates faced a free market, they'd move to market prices. 0% doesn't sound like a return buyers and sellers would agree on. That's why, regardless of the cost, the U.S. government can't allow interest rates to rise. Chapter 11, No More Recessions. No one trusts a sales pitch that promises unlimited profits with no risk. There must be a catch. It's normal for things to ebb and flow. That's how life works. That's how business works in a free market. Recessions are the ebb in the natural ebb and flow of capitalism. You may notice the U.S. doesn't have recessions anymore. Instead, we have unusually long boom times interrupted by a crisis. A recession and a crisis are two different things. Recessions were a necessary and normal part of a capitalist system. Crisis is part of a planned system, used to purge some participants while saving others. Sound familiar? How recessions used to work. Recessions worked like minor forest fires that burn back undergrowth. If allowed to burn, these fires clear excess clutter and debris. They don't harm large trees protected with thick bark. When the smoke clears, green shoots appear as the first sign of new life. The fire creates fertile ground for growth. Then the cycle repeats. For over 200 years, this is largely how the U.S. system worked. Improving conditions build confidence. People take risks to expand their business. At some stage, undisciplined types take too much risk. They overexpand. Then there are too many businesses serving too few customers. Business slows. The weakest operators fail. While this stings, it's the natural order of things in a capitalist system. The busted risk taker doesn't pay back the bank loan. The bank has to absorb the loss. The same goes for the landlord who leased space during the expansion. Everyone adjusts. Penance is a key part of recession. Not in the pious sense of the word. Penance in a recession means clearing the market of excess capacity. Say a town has 50,000 residents and 5 tire shops. The local economy grows at a modest pace. People drive more. That means they need more tires. It's good times for the tire business in town. People notice. A few of them decide they'll get into the tire business too. They take out loans to open tire shops. The local bank makes the loan because the tire business looks good after a few years of steady growth. Now there are 10 tire shops. Then comes recession. Business slows. The local mill lays people off. Overall, people drive less. That means they don't need new tires as often. The tire business gets tough. The weakest few tire stores close down. The first to go is the guy who borrowed too much to open his store. He spent heavily today with little regard for tomorrow. He borrowed to buy everything he now owns. Consequently, he can't handle one slow month. His store closes. While this sounds insensitive, it's the most humane system in the economic world. Just as fire naturally manages a forest, recessions thin out bad operators. The surviving stores grow more when business picks back up. However, preventing natural fire means the forest undergrowth piles up so high the inevitable fire is uncontrollable. It ravages an area 10 times the size of the small blaze occasionally set by nature. Crisis to crisis. Without recessions, the economy grows unchecked. This might not sound like a problem. In the early days, it's not. The problems come later. Think back to the early 2000s. After the September 11th attacks, the economy entered recession. I remember the 2002 recession well. This was the last capitalist recession in the U.S. At the time, I had my first serious job out of college. The company I worked for borrowed heavily in the 1990s to finance a buyout. This was before my time. When business slowed in 2001, it could not afford the interest payments on its debt. A Chicago-based competitor bought the firm for about 50 cents on the dollar. I joined the new management group charged with turning the business around. Without the crippling debt, we helped the new owners ramp up the business and sell it for over $800 million several years later. That's more than four times what they paid creditors for the indebted business just before I started in 2003. This is how things used to work. Borrowing too much during good times made it hard to survive a recession. The 2002 recession was different. For the first time ever, the Federal Reserve went off script. It stepped in to lower interest rates from 6.5% to 1%. This meant the Fed made it cheaper for banks to lend to each other. The idea was banks in turn would lend to customers at lower rates. Customers would spend that newly loaned money. This would jumpstart the economy. It worked. This happened for the first time on a grand scale across the entire U.S. financial system after the 2002 recession. Of course, some businesses failed. Not everyone had access to cheaper money. Think back to our example of the tire stores during a recession. In the good times, many new stores opened. They borrowed from local banks to get started. When business slowed, they struggled. Imagine instead if the local banker called the failing tire store and offered it lower interest rates. Don't close up shop. We'll lower your interest rate from 6.5% to 1%. No one can resist that. The problem is it rewards bad behavior. The disciplined tire store owner who made prudent decisions running his business watches as his spendthrift competitor gets a lifeline. Recessions affect everyone. No business gets out unscathed. Crisis, on the other hand, has selective effects. Some businesses get lifelines, others don't. Policymakers decide who to save. Problems emerge over time as business owners change the way they take risks. Expecting lifelines after each crisis means they no longer think like capitalists. The consequences of preventing recession. Have you ever known a successful couple whose kid can't get it together? He's polished, well-educated, and certainly capable. But for some reason, he can't get it into gear. It's the same story every time. The parents are go-getters. They tell you all about what Junior should do next. Meanwhile, Junior, smothered by these well-intentioned titans, hasn't developed any useful skills. Worse yet, he hasn't had any room for self-discovery. There's an easy fix for this. The parents don't want to hear it. Cut Junior off entirely, immediately. Subsidizing an unearned country club lifestyle neuters the entrepreneurial spirit. When problems arise, there are no skills to deal with them. Loving parents unintentionally prevented good potential from becoming great. The only way that happens is by experiencing life without a safety net. When the Fed got involved in the 2002 recession, it aimed to prevent the natural purging process that comes with recession. It took unnatural actions to shorten it. That planted the seed of a massive speculative housing boom that ended in crisis. Money moves like water flowing down a roof. Somehow, water always finds the lowest point. It travels down beams, under crevices, and through cracks. When it reaches the lowest point, there's nowhere else to go, then it pools. When the Fed lowered interest rates to an unnatural level in 2002, money flowed to profitable opportunities. Housing was one. Cheaper money lent between the Fed and its banks slowly lowered mortgage rates. One percentage point at a time, people refinance loans over and over again. Keep in mind, in a free market, banks would set the mortgage rates based on risk factors. Instead, the Fed's falling borrowing costs kicked off a race to lend as much as possible, regardless of creditworthiness. The result? Anyone who could fog a mirror took out a mortgage. Some people took out five of them. Then came what would have normally been a recession. The housing crisis. I know how this played out firsthand. In 2006, I had a trading partner. We shared all of our trading wins and losses, ideas, and thoughts about the market with each other. If you don't work for a major firm, this is a good idea. It keeps your thinking sharp. It can also keep you out of trouble. We both saw problems in the housing market. We sold short the stock of mortgage providers. This meant companies feasting on the mortgage boom. Technically speaking, we bet the market would notice the same problems we noticed and send these stocks tumbling. That didn't happen until 2008. We quit on our bet in late 2006 as the stocks kept rising despite our conclusions. Then came crisis. Recessions are humane. Some people fail. However, anyone can save, work hard, and take prudent risks. With a little experience and hard work, it's not too hard to survive a recession. Sure, there's sacrifice, but in the end, that sacrifice pays off. Crisis is different. Artificial excesses lead up to the crisis. In this case, lenders tripped over themselves to extend mortgage debt. Many lied on mortgage applications. They offered ninja loans. Ninja stands for no income, no job, no assets. What the Fed did in 2002 set the stage for the housing boom and bust. It altered the free market function that makes capitalism what it is. Tampering with free markets created incentives for reckless lending. Ninja loans don't happen in a capitalist system. No capitalist would take that kind of risk. They don't lead to a normal recession. Instead, they trigger a collapse. Crisis breeds chaos. With firsthand knowledge of how the housing boom and bust happened, I decided to become a landlord in 2009. It seemed like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to buy houses during a wholesale liquidation. I saw the underbelly of the housing crisis, entire city blocks boarded up. I didn't look at one house for sale that had an air conditioning unit. With the foreclosure process completed, nobody lived in these houses. Filled with mildew, spiders, and trash, bandits stripped them of everything from appliances to copper wire in the walls. Crisis creates unique opportunities. I bought abandoned houses for as little as $10,000. This would never happen during a normal recession in a capitalist system. Each time, I'd look up the court records and see the foreclosure judgment. On the $10,000 home, it was $150,000. I bought another for $25,000 with a $250,000 foreclosure judgment. People seemed to love hearing about my buying spree. Truthfully, it was difficult to watch. In the old days, banks chose borrowers wisely. If the mortgage went bad, it attended to the house until it sold to a more creditworthy borrower. In 2008, every mortgage ended up as part of a giant investment pool with no attentive owner. The fevered pace of lending turned into millions of soured loans. With knee-high grass and boards on the windows, whole neighborhoods looked abandoned. The sales process for foreclosed homes was so chaotic, I couldn't get agents to show them. Used to making six-figure incomes, they had no interest in showing a $25,000 home. Most of them gave me the code to the lockbox on the front door. I'd submit a cash offer and either hear back in a week or not. While this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, it was a sign of what's to come. It was proof to me that capitalism ended a decade prior. The 2008 crisis triggered some of the most radical monetary action in history. Crisis gave U.S. financial leaders the power to save some firms and purge others. That's a power that only comes with crisis. In a capitalist economy, recessions sort things out naturally. Crisis breeds chaos. It opens the door for more intervention. Nobody remembers the intervention that caused the crisis. With all eyes on the current crisis, emotions distract the public, while financial leaders pick who survives and who crumbles. The thing about a crisis is it builds and repeats until it wipes out the entire system. It leads to a reset of the system. In the end, recession would have been a better option. Chapter 12. The cure is worse than the disease. What's the problem with 0% interest rates? Would you loan someone your life savings for a 0% rate of return? Would you even bother building a life savings? Or would you spend every dollar on something you can enjoy today since waiting until tomorrow had no benefit? Interest rates represent the price of money. In a capitalist system, people with money decide what to charge borrowers. During times of serious economic stress, the cost to borrow naturally rises. In good times, there's plenty of money floating around, which sends borrowing costs down. This used to be how interest rates worked in the U.S. Not anymore. The first time the Fed radically dropped interest rates from 6.5% to 1%, it gave the economy a big boost. The idea was to encourage borrowing by making it cheaper to borrow. Newly borrowed money, in turn, would flow into the economy, dulling the effect of recession. The plan worked. Problem is, people bought things they didn't need. Extra houses, condos, cars, toys. It was a major boom. That unnatural boom helped shorten the 2002 recession. It improved the national mood. Politicians benefit from a controlled economy. There's almost always an American election around the corner, from congressmen every 2 years to the president every 4 years and senators every six. Facing voters for re-election during a recession can be a nightmare. During tough times, every question at the town hall meeting is, "When are you going to help me get back to work?" It's as if the politicians do the hiring and firing. This isn't new. Going back thousands of years, leaders knew a starving population led to trouble controlling the masses. When people get hungry, they attack. A free market capitalist system means a recession might conflict with an election. Since recessions play out naturally, there's not much the politician can do. The only fair answer when asked when a recession would end is, as soon as the economy clears out bad operators, growth will return naturally. This won't do. The Fed's modern interventions into what was once a free market is a dream come true for politicians. It didn't start out this way. Initially, the central bank was an independent authority. The idea for the Fed first emerged in the U.S. after the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. The quake set most of the city ablaze. A surge in insurance claims meant a flood of money rushing back into the western U.S. That caused turmoil in the currency markets. Mostly based in London at the time, insurance firms sold or transferred gold to fund dollar-based insurance contracts in San Francisco. They needed so many dollars, they sent the value of the dollar up dramatically, causing a panic the following year. Known as the Panic of 1907, it sparked calls for an independent U.S. central bank to oversee those money flows. Fast forward 100 years, and the bank is anything but independent. Politicians figured out downswings in the economy were tough. Just a little easing of credit conditions could help. Bad incentives create bubbles. In the summer of 2006, I took a weekend trip to Miami Beach. It was my first experience with what we later called the credit bubble. I had dinner at a restaurant called Tantra on Washington Avenue. It went out of business the following year. I'll never forget the scene. After walking in the front door, I said, "Smells like a grass lawn in here." The hostess told me Tantra appeals to all the senses. Every day, they laid fresh sod in the bar area to stimulate their guests' sense of smell. The visual appeal of the place was obvious. Miami Beach is already a spectacle. Here it looked like they hired dozens of scantily clad models to parade around. There was a bikini convention in town that weekend. One of the companies rented out a side dining room for a private party. It was incredibly chaotic. Remember, I went to Tantra for dinner. The concierge suggested it and got me a table. He told me several times how lucky I was to get a table. The implication was he needed a tip for arranging it. Finally, I sat down, table for two, next to the kitchen. Younger at the time, I cringed at the menu prices. The food was not great. Overall, it was a total bust. However, it was highly amusing. Tantra doesn't work in a normal capitalist economy. Nobody uses hard-earned savings to lay fresh sod on the floor of a cocktail lounge every day. That only happens with borrowed money in the absence of consequences. This was a sign of what we now know was a credit bubble. A bubble is what you get when you prevent natural capitalist forces from sorting out excesses in the economy. In short, when money flows unnaturally, it ends up in odd places. The problem with credit bubbles is they grow large, then bust. If politicians publicly pressure the Fed for extra help to soften the pain of the bust, it plants the seeds of a larger bust to come. Destroy the incentives. In a crisis system, every bubble is bigger than the last. When it pops, the mess is also bigger. The final bubble will make a mess so large it triggers a financial reset. What that means is the pattern of bubble crisis continues until everyone goes along with it, assuming another bubble follows. That means people get used to the pattern. The final bubble explodes, and there's no more steam left in the system. It resets. The price of everything converts to a new value under the new money system. It happens overnight. At that point, it's too late to prepare. Today, your incentive is to not prepare. Preparing means spending less than you earn, putting aside the difference for tomorrow. Meanwhile, the instant there's a sign of trouble, the Fed and the government step in with a rescue plan. They have the power to pick survivors and set the terms. Try to see the pattern. It's right in front of you if you care to look. The excesses of the 2006-2007 credit bubble hit extreme levels, triggering the 2008 bust. Nobody remembered the 2002 recession and the cheap credit created to artificially kick the economy back into gear. In the 2008 crisis, 158-year-old Lehman Brothers failed almost overnight. Entire city blocks had boards on the windows. Stocks crashed 57% from their 2007 high. It was a bloodbath. Meanwhile, financial news media ran wall-to-wall coverage of the crisis. Every story was a prediction of the next firm to fail. Insurance companies, auto manufacturers, pensions, banks all teetered on the brink. Again, no mention of the decisions earlier in the decade that set the stage for the crisis. Instead of letting the dust settle naturally, letting prudent firms survive and others fail, politicians urged the Fed to rescue the system. They said the world as we knew it would crumble if they didn't intervene. Each crisis paves the way for a new extreme in Fed money games. There's a tolerance to what worked last time. It takes something slightly bigger and more dramatic, otherwise there's no effect. $50 billion was a controversial sum needed to bail out the now-forgotten Mexican debt crisis in the 1990s. $700 billion was controversial in September 2008. In 2020, $2.8 trillion is not enough to ease the effects of the virus-related economic shutdown. If the Fed and its co-conspirators spoke in plain language, they'd face pitchforks. That's not going to happen. Instead, they used carefully worded statements to discuss the rescue plan for each crisis situation. These Orwellian word games work well. They distract people so thoroughly they almost forget there's a crisis. Get used to alphabet soup. There's a trick to deceiving people. George Orwell described it in his dystopian novel, 1984. Orwell showed how controlling speech controls behavior. Done effectively, the society evolves in the direction you send it. Today, the Fed and the government use acronyms to disguise the meaning of financially destructive actions. Acronyms sound important and credible. They change the way people talk about organizations or institutions. After a while, it becomes familiar to talk about an acronym without questioning its legitimacy. They also carefully choose the names of laws. The names appeal to the heart, not the head. They have emotional appeal while masking draconian language inside. For example, the Food Safety Act makes it virtually impossible for smaller farms to succeed. It's a green light for agribusiness, which is arguably far more dangerous than local produce. Acronyms also appeal to emotions. Take the CARES Act, for instance. Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. That sounds like something good, compassionate, supportive. Do a little digging and find the original bill introduced a full year earlier had a different name. The bills, laws, and programs of all scopes and sizes have hundreds of billions of dollars tucked in every corner. The CARES Act gave payments of $1,200 to citizens earning less than $75,000. Those payments totaled 15% of the legislation. The other 85%, or $1.8 trillion, went to thousands of companies, states, hospitals, universities, all financed by more government borrowing. This careful naming works well as cover for excessive money creation. If you called it what it is, people wouldn't stand for it. In 2008, the Fed unveiled TARP. That sounds like something practical, something that might keep you out of the elements on a camping trip. This TARP was the Troubled Asset Relief Program, designed to absorb at full price the soured loans left over from the 2002 to 2006 credit bonanza. Not every firm got a bailout, however. Lehman Brothers, for instance, didn't make the cut. Notice when we call it a bailout, it sounds bad. When we say Lehman Brothers wasn't eligible for TARP, it sounds like there were stringent requirements unmet by one bad actor. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson at the time said the exclusion of Lehman wasn't personal. His decades of competing with Lehman as CEO of rival Goldman Sachs didn't affect his decision. Regardless, Washington had the power to choose who survived. After the $700 billion TARP came QE, or quantitative easing. This phrase literally did not exist prior to the Fed branding it as something helpful and necessary. These two words bolted together disguise its true purpose. Using initially a modest $600 billion to buy mortgage-related bonds from certain banks, QE sounded like a stabilization mechanism. Nobody wants things to be unstable. However, no one bothered to connect the dots. The banks selling these bonds to the Fed were often the same ones that created the instability in the first place. Remember, the housing market boomed with the advent of ninja loans, no income, no job, no assets, and loose underwriting standards. At the first sign of trouble, these underwriters vanished. After raking in fees for years, the major banks risked going under, crippled by the weight of bad loans. The Fed's QE program bailed them out. It got the plumbing of the financial system flowing again. By June of 2010, the Fed had around $2.1 trillion worth of mortgages, bank debt, and treasury bonds. It paused its QE support in June. The market nearly tumbled. In August 2010, about 60 days later, the Fed launched QE2. This was the second round of quantitative easing. Remember, this is the second round of a word that had no literal meaning. When QE2 wrapped up, the market started to tumble. So the Fed launched QE3 in 2012, saying it would buy $40 billion of treasury bonds per month indefinitely. In the middle of all this, the Fed kicked off Operation Twist. This meant it could sell certain bonds and buy others to make interest rates resemble a healthy economy. I know it's confusing. You wonder how the Fed itself keeps it straight. Later came tapering, where the Fed promised to return things to normal by getting rid of some of the bonds it owned. That's impossible. The U.S. Central Bank is so intertwined in its financial markets, it is the market. The scope and scale of its involvement in what used to be free markets will never decrease. If it did, the system would collapse. The Fed held over $7 trillion worth of financial assets on its books as of May 2020. U.S. Treasury debt makes up more than 50%, mortgage debt about 25%. The Fed's balance sheet is 9 times larger than before the 2008 crisis. Every measure implemented is temporary, essential, and in the best interest of saving the system. Each time it slows the pace of expansion, markets tremble. The path from 7 to 10 trillion won't take long. Keep in mind, the value of all the gold ever mined in the world is about $10 trillion today. There's no scrambled acronym that can produce more gold. The supply grows slowly. It's an indestructible store of wealth in a time of destructive money and credit creation. Unlike the supply of gold, the Fed can create as many U.S. dollars as it needs. As long as the rest of the world accepts them, there's no limit to growth. Interest rates will never rise. As with all government action, artificially lowering interest rates was billed as a temporary measure. Manipulation is never temporary. It's the same as telling one lie, then another to cover it up. Before you know it, you're spending all day keeping track of these lies, making sure nobody gets the wrong story. It's exhausting. Lowering interest rates to 1% in 2002 staved off recession. After rates rose to just over 5% by 2006, the Fed lowered them back to 0% at the first sign of trouble. More borrowing softened the blow of the 2008 crisis. After 2008, the Fed left rates near 0% for roughly 8 years. Again, pinning rates at 0% was a temporary measure. If 8 years is temporary, I'd like to see permanent. Finally, in 2018, rates crept up to 2%. At one time, 2% was paltry. Now it was sky high. The wall started shaking. The financial system ran into trouble. The S&P 500 index fell 20% between late September and Christmas Eve. See this for what it is. It's an important warning sign of what's to come for the U.S. system. It's also proof this is not a free market. And if it's not a free market, the value of free market assets like stocks, bonds, and real estate are in trouble. Sustained rock-bottom interest rates created a feeding frenzy for asset managers. An unnatural force pinned interest rates at 0%. Big fund managers could borrow immense sums to make bets on low interest rates. This was easy money. With the Fed keeping interest rates unnaturally low, rates on everything else would surely follow. Rates on corporate bonds, for instance, fell and fell. When the interest rate on a bond falls, that means the price of those bonds rises. Fund managers bought bonds hand over fist. It wasn't due to renewed confidence in the fundamentals of the underlying company. It was due to the Fed's unnatural involvement in the debt market. Even junk bonds shot to new highs, minting fortunes not possible in a market free of intervention. At the first sign of increase, things got tight. After years of easy money, billionaire hedge fund managers like Ray Dalio of Bridgewater Associates called for the Fed to stop raising interest rates. Remember, we're talking about 2% after 8 years at 0%. Dalio said it best. In November 2018, he told CNBC the Fed action was hurting asset prices. That's trouble for his, at the time, $18.1 billion fortune, which he earned managing Bridgewater's $160 billion in investment assets. I have no problem with Dalio earning big bucks. He deserves it. He played the game properly. He'd be a fool not to pressure the Fed for more of what butters his bread. The issue is rates will never rise. If they do, the U.S. system crumbles. That triggers a dramatic financial reset. Dalio will be fine. Complacent savers won't. This brings us back to our initial question. Are you happy with a 0% return on your hard-earned wealth? I doubt it. Don't let the 0% interest rates distract you from the core issue. The U.S. is not a free market. There are implications. Stocks are a free market phenomenon. There's no stock market in Cuba. There's no free market for anything. It's a controlled system where the ruling party picks winners. Believe me, there are winners. One of my close friends is Cuban. I've been to Havana with him several times. He's connected there, which means life is good. He explained the process of buying property recently. There's no real defensive title, meaning you can buy it and you can own it, but down the road, you might not own it. That means you don't own it. Let's be clear, I'm not suggesting the U.S. could devolve to the level of an agrarian communist island nation. What I am saying is the absence of a free market means it's time to rethink your assets. Do you want stocks in a market that's not free? They don't function on fundamental free market pricing. Some win, some lose. You better choose wisely. Do you want to own real estate in a market that's not free? Tenants stop paying rent due to a possible virus outbreak. Forbearance measures prevent eviction for months. Meanwhile, you're on the hook for mortgage payments if you want to keep the property. Then you've got property taxes. The bloated city budget needs your support. You can't move the property. You might suffer a year or two of negative cash flow. Doesn't sound so exciting. This is a one-way street. 0% interest rates will never rise in a meaningful way. If they do, the entire system breaks. Not only will they not rise, they'll eventually go negative. When you face charges for holding money at a bank, you'll withdraw it and spend. That stimulates growth desperately needed by indebted companies and a government starved for tax revenue. At the slightest sign of rising interest costs today, the financial media, fund managers, and even the president apply public pressure to the Fed. They all know what would happen if rates did rise. In a free market, lenders ask a lot of questions before funding a loan. With interest rates pegged at 0%, any loan is profitable. That fuels a lending bonanza. It also creates zombie companies. A zombie company can't generate enough revenue to service its debt. That means it can only survive with more debt. In 2019, 10 years into a booming economic expansion, CNN Money reported 13% of companies in advanced economies were zombies. In 1980, the number was 2%. Zombie firms immediately go bankrupt without access to greater and greater supplies of debt. This is not about no-name firms peddling junk products. Major corporations borrow big to fund dividends, stock buybacks, and acquisitions.